Satara Satishi Shimada Savangri Sesi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Shri Haridas Thakura Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudhi Gaura Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shaila Kunda Radha Kunda Kiti Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaura Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Nama Om. Vishnu Padhaya Krishna Prasnaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvasesis and Nirvati Paskachade Shatarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vidam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijara Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamstra Panchakalpa Tri Vishaki Vasindri Vitapati Chanan Pavane Vyavaishnavi Vyavaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya April 2nd, 2018, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, on Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 29, Explanation of Devotional Service by Lord Kapila, Text 41. Yadvana Patayo Bita Lachascho Sadi Bisaha Sve Sve Kale Bigrinanti Pushpani Cha Palani Cha Yet.
Yet.
Because of whom?
Because of whom?
Vanaha Patayaha.
Vanaha Patayaha.
The trees.
The trees.
Vitaha.
Vitaha.
Fearful.
Fearful.
Lataha.
Lataha.
Creepers.
Creepers. Creepers.
Cha.
Cha.
And.
And.
Oshadibhi. Herbs.
Herbs.
Saha.
Saha.
With.
With.
Sve Sve Kale.
Sve Sve Kale.
Each in its own season.
Each in its own season.
Abhigrinanti.
Abhigrinanti.
Bear.
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 That's not like the animal, that means like to carry or produce. Pushpani. Flowers.
Flowers.
Cha.
Flowers. Cha.
And.
Kalani.
Kalani.
Fruits.
Fruits.
Cha.
Cha. Cha.
Also.
Also.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Out of fear of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the trees, creepers, herbs, and seasonal plants and flowers blossom and fructify, each in its own season. Purport. As the sun rises and sets and the seasonal changes ensue at their appointed times by the superintendence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so the seasonal plants, flowers, herbs, and trees all grow under the direction of the Supreme Lord. It is not that plants grow automatically without any cause, as the atheistic philosophers say. Rather, they grow in pursuance of the supreme order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is confirmed in the Vedic literature that the Lord's diverse energies are working so nicely that it appears that everything is being done automatically. Yad vana patayo bita latash chatu sad bihi saha se sve kale brigrinanti pushpani cha palani cha. Out of fear of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the trees, creepers, herbs, and seasonal plants and flowers blossom and fructify, each in its own season. So this verse reminds us of Ecclesiastes, very famous, in 3:1-8. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. So in today's verse, we look at the fact that there's good times for different things and that some of those times are beyond our control and some of those times we can cooperate with. And here it's saying that the trees, the creepers, the herbs, and the seasonal plants and flowers are all voluntarily cooperating with the Lord. Although they're doing so out of fear, still they are doing so. Their fear means that there is some emotion in them and there is some volition. And Prabhupada talks about how everything's being done at the order and the direction of God. So similarly, in our own lives, there are times and seasons that are forced upon us, and there are times and seasons that we can choose to act properly. Even the times that are forced upon us, we can choose how to respond to them. So we have times and seasons that we cannot control at all, but we can control our response. And then there's times and seasons that we can also create, all in harmony with the will of the Lord. So, of course, we see that the creation is that of seasons and times and cycles. And we see this, of course, on a yearly basis. I mean, even in a place here like Hawaii, where we're relatively close to the equator, there's still changes in the year. And there are some flowering trees and plants that produce flowers all year equally, but most of them have certain times of the year that they blossom and certain times that they don't. I mean, again, some fruits like papayas grow all year, and other fruits only grow at certain times of the year. And there's even some difference, it's a slight difference, but there's some difference between the seasons even here, with what kind of creatures abound, and slight differences in temperatures and in rains. And so there's some distinction on a yearly basis even here. And then we have, of course, the extreme places in the far north or the far south, where at certain times of the year they don't even have a daytime or they don't even have a nighttime. And then on a daily basis we have, of course, the changing times of the day, the sun rising and midday and sun setting and the time of twilight between those times and the fluctuations in temperature and so forth. And we have, of course, within the great cosmos, we have the changing, the movements of the planets that change, that there's the planets go, stars, they go through the different constellations, which then affect everything on this planet as they move through their different seasons, whether it's the moon that moves through all the constellations in a month, or Saturn that takes 30 years to go through everything. But there's these repeating seasons. And then, of course, we learn from the Vedas that there's huge seasons of the yugas, a golden age, right? And the silver age, and the copper age, and the iron age. So there's these grandiose seasons of spring, summer, fall, and winter. And so right now we are in the great cosmic winter, and the seasons, they're not of equal length. I mean, in temperate climates on this planet, the seasons are of roughly equal length, but the great cosmic cycle of seasons, the favorable seasons are much longer. And in the Satya Yuga, there's no need of agriculture. In the beginning of Satya Yuga, at least, there's no need of agriculture, there's no need of government, there's no need of demarcating towns and villages. People can just spend their time in meditation, and everything is just automatically provided. And then we have, in the next Yuga, the beginning of government, of villages, of agriculture. And then in the next Yuga, we have much more wars and nationalism and so forth. And then in this present Yuga, we're only 5,000 years into the Yuga, but everything is already chaotic. And we are going deeper and deeper into the earth to get the minerals that in Satya Yuga were on the surface of the earth. We have to work the earth so much harder to get agriculture and so forth. So there's these seasons, and then again at the end of winter, it will be spring. And then, of course, these yugas, after they cycle 1,000 times, then there's another great cycle where Brahma goes to sleep. And there's Bhutva, Bhutva, Pralita. Again and again and again, there's destruction and there's creation. And that's on an even grander scale, that every 1,000 yuga cycles, there's a sleeping time of Brahma, and then an awakening, and again, a recreation. And then there's an even greater cycle than that, and that of Brahma's life, and the breathing out. Yakari narna vajale bhajati sma yoga nitrama anta jagadanda sarona kupad hara shakti mavalambya paramaswamurti. That the Lord is breathing out the universe, and it comes into existence, and then he breathes it in. And so there's this cycle of creation and annihilation on this grandiose scale. So we have the huge creation and annihilation in a cycle. We have Lord Brahma's waking and sleep cycle. Then within that we have the yuga cycles. Within that we have the celestial cycles. Within that we have our yearly seasons. Within that we have the changing of the moon in the month from new moon to full moon. And within that we have the cycle of the days, our sleeping and waking cycle. And then, of course, each of us has our life cycle. Each of us as an individual, we have our birth, our growing up, our becoming a mature adult, our producing some byproducts in the form of children, or in the form of various products of our work in the world, and then starting to dwindle, and then finally death, and then again rebirth. And of course, with the life cycle, the death of one becomes the birth substance of the other. So when a body dies, the ingredients of that body become the fuel and food for the birth of something else, the compost heap. Nourishes the next seeds, and so the death goes to rebirth. And then there's also the water cycle. The water percolates through the earth to get cleaned, it gets evaporated to get cleaned, it gets rained again, so we have this constant cycle of cleaning. And all of these cycles and changes are given by the Lord. Of course, as we've discussed before, there's also cycles even in the spiritual world. So we have the Astakalila Lila cycle, where the Lord has this cycle of events in his day. And perhaps there's other greater cycles in the spiritual world. I haven't heard of them, but I wouldn't be surprised. As they are here, they must reflect something there. So, but we do know that Krishna has the Astakalila Lila, the cycle of events within a particular day. Where, as we've discussed before, he wakes up in the forest with the cowherd maidens, and then he goes back into the village, and again he appears to awaken there, and he takes care of the cows, wrestles with his boyfriends, has a bath, has breakfast, and spends time with his parents. Then he goes into the forest with the cows and calves, buffalo and goats, with his cowherd boyfriends. He plays in the forest. Then he goes away and meets with the maidens, and they swim and they play, and again he leaves them and goes with his friends, and they take care of the cows and play, and then they return to the village where again he has a bath, he milks the cows, has dinner and sees entertainment, and then he goes off into the forest for his nightly dancing and playing. So 8 times of the day, 2 with the cowherd girls, 2 with the cowherd boys, 2 with the parents, predominantly. And so we see those sort of cycles. And then, of course, it's explained, very nice to explain that Ananda Vrindavan Champu of Karvikarnapur, that there are 6 seasonal forests in Goloka Vrindavan, and then one of the forests has, it's one forest that has all seasons simultaneously. So Krishna can go into the monsoon forest and the rainy forest, and and the dewy forest and the winter forest and so forth. Each has different kinds of fruits and flowers, and he and his friends dress differently and do different activities and so forth. So there's some sort of this cycle and variety that exists even in the ultimate reality. So then the question becomes, how do we deal with these? How do we deal with these? What's our response? So some of these changes are beyond our control. There's some of these, when we're born, when we die, exactly when we become an adult, you know, when our hair starts turning gray, these things are not within our control. And then we have certain things that are in our control. We can choose when to laugh, as in Ecclesiastes, when to laugh, when to cry, when to embrace, when not to embrace. These are things that we can choose to do. So even those, of course, are in response to external forces beyond our control, but we have a greater measure of freedom in order to choose those. So the Vedas give very clear instructions as to how to respond to the natural cycles as ordained by God. And of course we have, starting at the lowest level, on a daily basis. So on a daily basis, the different times of the day are governed by different modes of nature. So there's a time in the early morning when the modes are in equilibrium, and then the mode of goodness is dominant, and then the mode of passion, and then the mode of ignorance. So we are enjoined that as soon as the modes are in equilibrium, we should get up from bed. And in that time, and when the modes are in goodness, we should engage in meditation, we should engage in study of the scripture, we should engage in worship of the deity. So we should spend that time in very direct spiritual activities, because that time is conducive. We will get help from the time. And then when the mode of passion kicks in, we are enjoined to be active. And that's when we're supposed to engage in our livelihood. If we're a grihastha, if we're a student, it's when we're supposed to engage in our study. If we're in the renounced order, it's when we should do our preaching, our austerities, our purification of existence, and so forth. And then when it switches to the mode of ignorance, then we are supposed to sleep. And at the junctions of the sunrise and noon and sunset, we are supposed to retreat into a meditative state. So that's on a daily basis. And of course, one can work with that or one cannot work with it. Again, you know, one can try to meditate during the time of the mode of ignorance, or work in the middle of the night and it's a mode of ignorance. One can try to sleep when the mode of passion is active, and so forth. But it will be much more difficult. It will be much more difficult. And there's a lot of just biological evidence that working with these natural cycles contributes to our health. The people who regularly work at night, especially certain times during the night, if we're awake, then our bodily functions won't operate properly. Of course, there's some research that shows that each individual has their own particular cycle of what time of day they are the most capable of being productive. And if we're a little alert to this, we can also see that some of us, like myself, I'm the most useful very early in the morning, and I'm not really very useful after about 6 or 7 o'clock at night. So, you know, whereas I know people who are the opposite. I know people who, it's at 6 or 7 o'clock at night that they really become the most functional. And to work with that. So we also have, just like Srila Prabhupada would wake up very early, he'd wake up like at midnight or 1 o'clock, and he would work on his books in the, you know, middle of the night, as would Bhaktivinoda Thakur would also do that. So we each have our own particular cycles and our own particular biologic. And also we have particular needs during the day according to our life situation at the time. So when I was running a school, I used to sleep after the school was out for the day. I'd sleep for a few hours, and then I could stay up late at night when everybody was sleeping, and I could correct papers and write articles and things like that. So one may also have particular cycles that one goes through according to one's specific circumstances. And then we have the greater cycle of our life. So the Vedas prescribe for the greater cycle of our life two things, of which I'm aware, and there may be more. One is the samskaras. So the samskaras are basically what we might call rites of passage, where they're ceremonies of markers of various times in life. And there, a lot of the samskaras occur in the very early part of life. There's the garbhadhan samskara that the husband and wife do at the time of conception. And then there's two or three samskaras during the woman's pregnancy. There's a samskara right after birth of giving the child their name. And then there's a samskara when the child's very young, when they get their first haircut. And then another one when the child first goes to school. So there's then when they first start studying the scriptures. So a lot of these samskaras are happening in very, very early in life. And then there's a samskara of getting married and taking up the renounced order and so forth. So these are a way of taking the natural changes in life and sanctifying them. So there's some sort of samskaras that go on in all human societies. Particularly, most human societies have some kind of samskaras that happen somewhere around puberty. And there's usually human societies have some kind of samskaras of dedication to religion. I mean, we have our initiation, our Harinam initiation, our Gayatri Diksha into the Vaishnava mantras. And then there's, you know, among the Catholics, there's the confirmation. In many Christian religions, they have baptism. Of course, they usually baptize a baby, the Anabaptists that do it a little later, like initiations. The Jews have their bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah. But, you know, even in the indigenous people, excuse me, the tribal people, they have some sort of ceremonies like that. And still in human society, there's some sort of marriage ceremony, although it's decreasing both in the prevalence and also decreasing in meaning. So the meaning of marriage as a spiritual sanctification is decreasing. It's becoming more a legal and a tax and insurance partnership. But there's still that is there, and of course there's the funeral ceremony, which is still done in most cultures. When people retire from work, there's a retirement party. We have, you know, graduation ceremonies. There you can graduate from kindergarten, graduation from high school, secondary school, graduation from college, and so forth. And even if these rites of passage have become very secularized, many of them have become stripped of their spiritual component. But we see that they're often still very ritualized. Certain you wear special clothing, like for my graduation, you know, I had to buy or rent certain clothing, and there's a particular ritual that you go through and so forth. So there's something to mark the life seasons and the changes in life. And I mean, psychologists have even decided that we have a need for these, that we have needs for these kind of markers, you know, even birthdays and anniversaries and things like that, or you know, completion of a project. We have some kind of marker that makes an impression, and samskara means an impression, that we get a particular impression. We get a particular mark in our psyche that something has been started or something has been completed, or we have made some sort of vow, and there's some we make an impression. We have witnesses, we have, again, special clothing, perhaps special foods, we have special rituals that we don't normally do, and these things are a voluntary act on our part to acknowledge and work with what is already happening. And then, of course, we have the life cycle of the ashramas, the brahmachari ashram, the grihastha ashram, the vanaprastha ashram, and the sannyas ashram. So these ashrams are meant to be a way of, on a large scale, sanctifying the normal life cycle. So, you know, a little small scale, you have your graduation ceremony, your starting school ceremony, you have the wedding. But the grihastha ashram goes beyond just a wedding that happens in some, you know, temple or church. But it's a sanctification of the whole married life. And the same, the brahmachari ashram is beyond just the school starting ceremony or the graduation ceremony, but it's a sanctification of the whole student life. So these are natural things in the life cycle, where as children we have to learn, whether we formally go to a school or whether we're just picking up on what our tribe is teaching us, or we're learning our craft from our parents. In childhood we're learning. In the youthful time of life, most human beings are engaged in some sort of earning of a livelihood, some way of living, some way of eating and getting shelter that they pay for, either directly, they directly provide those things, or they do it through barter, or they pay for it. And most human beings in that time of life are engaged in some sexual relationships. And then in the once middle age hits, then one's energy for making a livelihood decreases, one's energy, one's interest in changing the world decreases, one's interest in sexuality and sexual relationships decreases. And then at the very end of life, one is preparing for death. One's interests generally become narrow. One's body is failing, one's abilities are failing, and one is trying to purify one's existence and prepare for death. So these things happen to everybody if they live long enough, and generally most human beings go through this natural of learning, working and sexual activity, of retiring and slowing down, and then preparing for death. And this season that happens to us, these seasons happen to us whether we like them or not. We go from a child to a mature adult. We go from the youthful time to middle age. We go from middle age to old age. And whether we want to do them or not, they happen. But we can cooperate with them by doing them in a sanctified way. So when we're young, we can study the Vedas. We can study the scriptures in addition to studying how to become an engineer, how to become a doctor. And in that time, we can develop devotion to our teachers, to a spiritual master. And we can refrain from sense gratification. We can live very austerely and very simply. We can learn the art of the control of our senses and the control of our mind, an art which will serve a human being for their entire life. We can learn how to live on very little. We can learn how to make the things that we need. And then in the next stage of life, in the married stage of life, so we can learn sense control, not to use the spouse simply as an object for unlimited sex, but to have sex be a sacred act, an act that's designed for the production of good children that will be a benefit to the world. Children who are moral, who are ethical, who are spiritual, who are responsible, who are respectful, those kind of children. Good citizens, as Prabhupada would say, you know, that our children should also be good citizens. And we were just reading in the story of Dhruva Maharaj here in our morning program how the leaders of the Krishna consciousness movement should start educational institutions all over the world to train children in Krishna consciousness, and then the face of the world will change automatically. So if in the grahast, if the married couples are actually having an ashram, then the whole world will change just by raising very nice children. And then also the sanctification of that ashram is to earn money honestly according to one's nature, and to share that wealth, to share the literal money, to share the opulences that come from that wealth, the renunciation, the knowledge, the strength, the power, the beauty, and so forth, to share those with the world. And in that time of life specifically, one should propagate religion. It is particularly the sacrifices that, and sacrifices means the religious rituals, religious observance, are meant to be funded and supported primarily by those in their youthful time of life, to build the churches and the mosques and the temples, and to make sure that there's regular religious observance in the world, that, that God is connected with everything in the world, to desecularize the world. And then when it's time to retire, instead of divorcing and marrying another spouse, which has become the popular thing in middle age, or looking for a new career, one should take the natural dissatisfaction that happens with marriage and career at that time, and one should then go to celibacy and simplicity. And just like in the world, people like to travel in their retirement, so one can travel to holy places, to temples and to sacred places, and gradually detach oneself from the children and the grandchildren and the home and the finances and the concerns like that, but dedicate oneself, whether with the spouse or separately, to the service of the Lord. And then as the body increasingly fails, and as the notices of death become more frequent and more varied and more broad, then one works on the total purification of existence to prepare for one's journey. And just like in a few weeks I'm going to start traveling again. And last night I had anxiety dreams about that things weren't packed. You know, that I wasn't ready for my trip, that I hadn't taken care of my deities yet, and I had to go to the airport. And so, you know, at the time of death, one needs to be ready. One needs to be ready. The plane's going to take off whether we're ready or not. It's a question of whether or not we're ready. So the end of life is for that, and of course also for sharing one's wisdom with the society and guiding the society. So in this way, one works with the natural biological seasons of one's life. Now, it's a question for us. You know, and then we also, you know, work with the greater seasons. Do we want to work with these natural seasons, or do we want to fight them? That's our question. And then the next question is, if we do want to work with them, do we want to work with them out of fear, like is described here, bhiti, out of fear, or do we want to work with them out of love and affection? So do we want to work with them, or do we want to fight them? So the example in the Shastra of somebody who fought them was Hiranyakashipu. So it was described that Hiranyakashipu would force the plants to bear out of season. He would force them to work against their nature. And such forcing is the hallmark of our civilization at the present time. Right? We live in homes where we regulate the temperature as to make it as if it was always the same season all year long. We fly in fruits and vegetables from all over the world. You know, we're eating strawberries all year, as if the strawberries grew all year in our locality. Even in our local area, we try to force the plants in so many ways to extend the season. So we're trying to force. We're trying to force the bodies, right? The birth control and abortion is trying to force the bodies. Plastic surgery, hair dyeing, trying to force the body, Viagra, you know, all these chemicals, and we're trying to force the body to be different from its seasons. You know, we're trying to force when we're fertile, we're trying to force when we're old, we're trying to force when our trees bear fruit, we're trying to force what season it is, we're trying to force everything. And you can see that we're trying to force mostly into a kind of seasonless, we're trying to eliminate a lot of the variety. And of course, the results of this forcing are not very good. They're not very good on the health of the individual body, and they're not very good for the health of the planet. We're trying to force the land to produce without letting it rest. We're trying to force people to produce without rest, 24-hour shifts. You know, it's... I remember when I was a child, when television first came out, and it was only live television, just like 3 or 4 channels. That was in New York City, and just during the daytime. You know, and now there's hundreds and hundreds of TVs, movies, 24 hours a day. The Late Show, and the Late Late Show, and the Late 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 Show. No sleep, and you know, when you're tired, take some coffee, and then you have to take one chemical to wake up and another chemical to go to sleep. And all this is a result of forcing. You know, trying to push back against the will of the Lord, trying to push back against the natural flows that happen within our own body, the natural chemical flows that happen in our own body and in our mind, at the flows that happen on a daily basis and in seasons and in the cosmos. So this is not, we've not been very good at this. We've really, you know, whatever forcing we've been able to accomplish comes at a very high price. And we end up just damaging. When I was a child, one of the things my father said to me over and over again was, don't force. He said, when you force something, you break it. When you force something, you break it. And this is true in general, that if we try to force our body, we try to force our mind, we try to force the environment, we simply break things. And then, you know, we're stuck with a broken thing. So then it's a question, if we're going to, as they say, go with the flow, what is going to be our mood? Is our mood going to be fearful? Well, you know, oh well, I just got to work with this. You know, fear is very much connected with the modes of passion, ignorance. And then you get into this sense of just duty and responsibility, and it's what I have to do. You have a lot of words like should and have to in your life, and you have a lot of language about I don't have a choice. So it's one of the evidences that we're obeying out of fear is the shoulds and have to language, and I don't have a choice, and what else can I do? And then we're going with the flow, but with resentment and with bitterness and with our stories of grievance, and that also is not good for us. These things are, they actually make us ill mentally and physically. I mean, better to obey out of fear than not to obey at all. Definitely, to fear God, to act out of fear of God, fear of punishment, fear of disease, fear of hell. That's far, far, far superior than to be fighting against forces against which we'll never win. And the ideal is that we go with these things in a loving way, that we see that it's a loving, personal God who knows what is the right time for each thing. And to not hate that. There's going to be times of tiredness and times of alertness. There's going to be times when there's happiness and there's sorrow. And it's not just Matrisparsha Sukante Sitos Nasukudagama Payanonichastam Satiksha Subharata. We study this tiksha to be tiksha, to be tolerant. That tolerance is not a suppression, a repression. But it's an acceptance. It's an acceptance. There'll be times of mourning and there'll be times of celebration. There'll be times when I have friends and support, and then there's times when the world seems to be seems to be full of enemies, like Kunti, who felt like she was a deer in the midst of tigers. And going out of love means one who does not hate illumination, attachment when they appear. Illumination, attachment, and delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear, knowing that the modes alone are active and that he is transcendental. So when we go along with love, then we see, yes, now my body is healthy, now my body is sick. Now my body is alert, now my body is tired. There's sadness in my mind, there's joy in my mind, there's anger in my mind and body, but I am not any of these things. I am not any of these things. How can I work with these flows and seasons and changes in a way that honors the Lord, in a way that respects these changes, in a way that is loving? One can see it ultimately as a dance. So Prabhupada says the whole world is full of Krishna's singing, and the whole world is full of Krishna's dancing. And it is a question of whether or not we want to dance with Krishna, dance independently, or try to dance with somebody else. So a materialistic person in the present time tries to do their own dance. They're not in harmony with the rhythm and the melody of the Lord. And those who love the Lord, they're dancing with the Lord. They're following his lead. And of course, they're also doing, you know, when you're dancing with somebody, it's not robotic. It's a loving exchange of give and take. And this, it's not even give and take, it's sharing. So that we share with the Lord. It's not a mercantile thing. That we understand his indications through the natural cycles of the universe and the solar system and the planet and the geographical location that we're in and our particular body and mind. We understand his indications through these things as a dance, as a song. And we work with him in that way. And then Prabhupada says that the materialist, everything seems very aggressive, but to one who is in Krishna consciousness, everything becomes very happy. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements.
Just a second.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. So nice to hear your voice, Mahalakshmi.
Nice to hear you too. I have a question that... So I understand that the more we flow with what Krishna is giving us now and give our energy into it happily for the opportunity, then the more we act in this way, then the easier will be if in the future he brings out some other opportunities.
Yes.
It will be then easier.
Yes. Yes, because these things are changing. I mean, part of the proper response to these cycles and seasons, as Krishna says, material nature is endlessly mutable. But even though you could say the spiritual world is changeless, as I said, there's also the Astakalila Lila, the six seasonal forest. So there's this variety, and yes, the more that we try to respond in this present moment to the particular season and time and place, then the better that we can adjust when that changes. And it does, it changes. It changes. So the proper response today may not be the proper response tomorrow. The proper response today at 10 in the morning may not be the proper response today at 10 in the evening.
It's culture to try to grow things out of season is that most plants have a sensitivity to the length of the day.
Yes.
We call it photosensitivity. So what growers do is they'll string lights out. In fact, we did it back in the 70s in Miami. We were growing marigolds, the great big marigolds, and shipping them to temples for the deities all around America. But the big ones, the really nice ones, only grow during the summertime. So what I learned from the other flower growers, if you string lights out up on poles at night and literally light up, so artificially light up the field, people drive by and they see in the middle of the night the whole field is lit up like a stadium or something. And the plants, they think, you time it such that they think that it's still, you're coming into spring or it's
summertime. Yes.
And they grow in great proliferation.
That reminds me of what I've heard of Las Vegas, how to keep people gambling as long as possible, they have all artificial lighting inside.
And no windows.
No windows. And they also use different scents that provoke alertness. I mean, the modern office building also, you know, the modern office building, even if they have windows, they don't open. And they, you know, what I've also read about is doctors. You know, it's very interesting because the Ayurvedic, one of the things you learn in Ayurveda is you learn how to treat diseases and how to promote health according to the time of day, the time of the lunar month, and the time of the year, and then the general life cycle. In modern medicine, they actually, part of the training for doctors, I mean, I'm sure it's not exactly intentional that it has this effect, but, you know, the residents often have to work 80 to 120 hour weeks, and they do these variants of shifts, and they often have, the doctors also often don't have any exposure to natural sunlight for days at a time. You know, that messes up their own biological clocks. And they're thinking, you know, well, if they're doing that to the doctors, how are the doctors going to be able to treat the patients in accord with the with nature? So we do that. We specifically do that to doctors. Again, I think sort of, you know, not perhaps with the purpose of messing up their clock, but that is what is done. In many hospitals, also, the windows don't open.
Another thing we see is that people are living in places that I suppose are not really meant for human habitation.
Yes.
Like living way up north or way down south during closer to the polar caps. And I forgot the term for the depressions that they often have, that they have to take medication because of such long, you practically never see the sun during their winter season. It's the day length is so incredibly short.
Yeah, it's really a problem. Well, it also makes me think about the Gulf countries, which are deserts, and they don't have any natural source of water. They have to desalinate the ocean water, and it also gets so hot there. You know, traditionally, there were very small numbers of people that lived in those places. Yes, seasonal affective disorder, Kandita is telling us. So traditionally, there were very small groups of nomadic people that lived in those desert areas that basically depended on animals like camels and goats and the oases. And now these are very built-up areas, and they're built up by, you know, drilling the oil and by air conditioning. So it's and by desalinating the ocean water. But it's not a sustainable thing. You know, or you see in America also how we've dealt with the various climates and diverting the water, and these things, they're just not sustainable. The mood of the, particularly the Vaishyas, the ideal Vaishya has a mood of sustainability and regeneration of the natural resources of the earth. Those are the the dharma of the Vaishya is to be asking those questions. Is it sustainable? Can it be regenerated? And the modern Vaishyas specifically do things that are not sustainable or regenerative. The modern Vaishya mentality is, you know, just take the egg and cut off the goose's head. And who cares about future generations? Who cares about anything? You know, just artificially take every, you know, force everything now.
Don't want to forget about them.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, yeah, what's going on even with the seeds, and it's just there's a general mood in the planet today, whether it's on the platform of just one's individual physical body, the animals, the earth, everything, to try to fight against the natural give and take in the seasons and the times.
It's exploitation to make a buck.
Yes.
I like when you said that they don't give the land any time to rest.
You know,
it is like a Aranyakashipu. It's driven.
Yes.
And there's no regard for the earth. None.
None.
You know, it's just we want to exploit everything to the maximum.
Absolutely.
So that we can profit.
Immediately. We want to profit immediately. You know, and it's a very, very tamagun mentality. I mean, even in rajagun, one thinks about sustainability and regeneration. It's only in tamagun that in deep tamagun, is immediate gratification without concern for consequences. So it's just, you know, what can I do to immediately be happy? And never mind what kind of forcing I have to do in order to accomplish that.
It's funny, I was kind of wrestling a little bit with how I was going to illustrate this one chapter in this illustrated Gita I'm working on. And the illustration would be a full page or be all kinds of images, but to illustrate that this world is a passing show. This class really, really, really helped. And another thing I liked what you said that reminded me of something that Srila Prabhupada once told his godbrother, Sridhar Maharaj, that he was translating with great difficulty. And what he meant by that, in the middle of the night, because his days were full with managing and expanding Krishna consciousness all over the world. So Prabhupada made a big sacrifice. I mean, he really wanted to translate the Bhagavatam, and he could have stayed at Radha Damodar and just translated with his sadhana there.
Right.
But he felt compelled to, you know, go to America and start the worldwide, you know, global expansion of Krishna consciousness.
Right. Which meant the translating in the middle of the night.
Right, which ended up, he had to get up at 1 or 2 in the morning to do the translating.
Actually, I know one devotee in ISKCON who's written so many books, I mean, amazing amount of books, and one time when I was at Govardhan, he was also out there at Govardhan and staying at the palace. So I thought I would, you know, when I was walking by, I thought I would say hello. And I remember I stopped by about 9 in the morning, and Keshavabharti Maharaj says, "Oh no, he's sleeping. He writes all night and sleeps during the day." Another time I was by about 3 in the afternoon, I said, "Oh, is he here?" He says, no, he writes all night and sleeps all day. And I thought, well, that's one way to get rid of people who are going to bother you. You know. You can't have anybody visiting you and bothering you if you're writing all night and sleeping all day. So it's interesting. Interesting way to get your books done. Hide someplace and then don't be available during the day. Get out of sync with the normal rhythm of most people.
Do you have time for one more question? Is it too late?
We can have one more and then I need to go.
Okay, in this verse it's talking about the trees and the plants that out of fear of the Lord, they're bearing flowers and fruits, etc. So you would think that a plant wants to bear fruits and stuff like that without any relation to the Lord at all. It's not out of fear. So I was thinking that, you know, like let's say in younger years, boys and girls are chasing each other because they want. You know, where is fear in there?
Huh. Well, you see in modern society, what are people doing? They're intentionally not having children during their peak fertile years. So the time of greatest fertility for a woman is 18 to 20, and for a man it's 20 to 22. And they're intentionally avoiding pregnancy then, and you know, then they're looking to get pregnant in like 35. Often then they have to use sort of assistive technology. So we see that although they're very inclined towards sexual relationships, they're not so inclined towards reproduction. But what does reproduction do? As soon as you reproduce, you're giving your best energy to your children, both literally on a physical platform. The reproductive fluids in the body are the most concentrated form of energy in the body. And this is why, like, we often eat seeds. You know, the staple foods in the world are primarily seeds, the grains. That's the reproductive parts of the plant, because that's where the energy is concentrated. Well, it's the same with the human body, that our digestive process, again, if you study Ayurveda, the different aspects of the body get more and more and more and more and more and more concentrated, and the ultimate concentration is the reproductive cells and reproductive fluids. And when you expend those in having a child, you're giving your best energy, your most concentrated energy to that child, which is what you're supposed to do. And you're supposed to have those children during the time when your own body has its peak energy and your own body has its peak health and vitality, so that you can really produce the best children, the best, most healthy children, the best children mentally, and that you can personally have enough energy to take care of them and still take care of yourself. But we see that the human beings prefer to use that extreme energy and vitality for their own selfish pursuits. And, you know, the driving force for reproduction, the driving sexual desire for reproduction, instead they're using just to have, you know, excessive sexual encounters. And I wouldn't be surprised if plants might feel the same way. You know, there's many plants that reproduction for them means death. That they expend their energy into, I mean, just like if you're growing, you know, Narhari was talking about marigolds. If you're growing marigolds, if you don't pick the flowers, then the flowers produce seeds. And the plant becomes weak because the plant is pouring its energy into those seeds. And the death of the plant will be hastened by producing seeds. Whereas if you keep picking the flowers before the seeds are mature, the plant will just keep producing flowers and keep producing flowers and keep producing flowers. So there could be among the plants some that they're reproducing to please the Lord. Because you might say that there's some desire to spread, you know, the evolutionists say that the DNA practically has a desire to replicate itself, which I think is a bunch of nonsense. But there's a real sacrifice in reproduction. It's a real giving of oneself and one's energy. And there are many, many, many living entities where reproduction marks the end of their life. There are many insects where reproduction marks the end of their life, and many plants where, especially the annual plants, where it marks the end of their life. So I think there might be some fear involved. You know, I'm supposed to do this. And I think for a lot of people, you know, a lot of people who have children young in the at the present time in society, unless they're just sort of, you know, whatever happenstance, are religious people. So in the present time, those who are marrying young and having a lot of children are doing so to please God, because it's God's rule. It's God's desire to be fruitful and multiply and to have good children. And they're making that sacrifice and that effort in their prime of life to please the Lord. They're sacrificing the time that they could go out and party and things like that. And they may do it out of fear of God, that they want to. They want to be rewarded and not punished, or they may be doing it out of love.
Maybe many humans that also would consider that if you have children, it marks the beginning of the end of your life in a kind of a jokey way. But in the other way, as you pointed out, that that's one of the reasons they do take birth control, because they recognize it may be the end of their one type of life and another type of life.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I've seen many devotees do this, you know, avoid having children or have children very late, in the name of, well, I want to do more service, which is often, frankly, I mean, sometimes that's valid, but many, many times it's simply the same mentality that, you know, I want to just focus on myself and my career, and you call your career service when that's not really what's going on. But one of the best services that anybody can do is to produce a good population. And if you're not going to have children, then you should be producing a good population through preaching. It's our, you know, it's the best use of our energy, that instead of using our energy just simply for our own satisfaction, that at the, especially when we, whatever we have, whether we have youthful energy or whether we have old age wisdom and not much youthful energy, you know, we should be producing a good population in the world. We're not meant, especially as followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we're not really meant to just be Bhajan and Undis taking care of ourselves. We're supposed to be giving our energy, sacrificing our energy, either, you know, biologically with good children or preaching, disciples and students, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. And if doing so, you know, means we have less for our own sense gratification, well, that's our offering. All right, I need to go right away. I'm late. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Krishna.